Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, interesting report out of the RAND Corporation this week, which shows how one sector of the population is already benefiting from the Affordable Care Act.
Well, that's right, Mark. In this case, we're talking about the 3.1 million young Americans who've been able to stay on their parents' health policy up to age 26. RAND looked at the number of young adults who sought treatment in hospitals for non-discretionary treatments. There was no option about getting care. Broken bones, appendicitis, non-elective emergency.
Well, these are not terribly expensive conditions for the most part. To the uninsured, the cost can be catastrophic. Turns out insurers paid $147 million in hospital claims for these young adults during the course of the year in 2011, money that would have had to come from themselves were they not insured.
And we should note that the hospitals benefited as well, Mark. As you know, when an uninsured person can't pay their medical bills, the hospitals have to absorb the loss. Some of that is transferred to the rest of the population that is insured. And the study shows the law in this case indeed protected the people it was supposed to. Patients got the care they needed, and still the hospitals were appropriately compensated too.
You know, the study also proves that even the so-called invincibles, those young, healthy folks who put off buying insurance, do indeed benefit from having coverage for emergencies.
And coverage not just for emergencies, of course, but for primary and preventive care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the report showed how important it is to have this real data available to analyze what is the impact of the Affordable Care Act. And in fact, there's an interesting article written by the president's former health advisor, Dr. Zeke Emanuel, calling for a transparency initiative in healthcare pricing.
His article appeared in the journal Annals of Internal Medicine, calling for a bolder initiative to make claims data available for free so health consumers can understand the real cost in healthcare. That's something our guest today has been working steadily towards.
Patrick Miller is the founder of the All Payer Claims Database Council based at the University of New Hampshire. His organization seeks to promote initiatives in states across the country to make health insurance claims data available to the public, to consumers, and to researchers.
We also have a visit from Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, you can email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you.
We will get to our interview with Patrick Miller in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. The healthcare law and mounting challenges. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor has said he'll try again in June to pass a bill that would gut what the GOP are calling a multi-billion dollar slush fund in the Affordable Care Act. Republican leaders tried in April to kill the Prevention and Public Health Fund as part of a bill that also sought to boost funding for a pre-existing conditions insurance plan. And Eric Cantor said they now have reworked that bill. According to Cantor, the Helping the Sick Americans Now Act has been retooled. Instead, the bill would fund state-based high-risk pools, something Cantor called the conservative policy answer to helping Americans with pre-existing conditions. From congressional challenges to legal ones, with the healthcare law running headlong into full implementation, it's not without a fair degree of headwinds. Despite surviving a stiff challenge at the Supreme Court last year, some of the law's biggest provisions remain at risk from legal challenges. One set of lawsuits accuses the Internal Revenue Service of illegally implementing new subsidies to help people buy insurance. Separately, more than 60 lawsuits have been filed challenging the law's mandate for health plans to cover birth control. And hospitals are starting to just say no to meat raised with antibiotics. The University of California San Francisco Medical Center is taking a bold step, its leadership agreeing unanimously to phase out the purchase of meats from animals raised with antibiotics, a practice that many scientific studies have shown has led to the increase of antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria. UCSF Medical Center is urging the 10 other hospitals in the University of California system to follow suit. Perhaps the new slogan will be, "Where's the grass-fed beef?" I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Patrick Miller, founder and co-chair of the National All Payers Claim Database Council, which seeks to improve health care in this country through health cost transparency, a collaboration with the New Hampshire Institute for Health Policy and Practice at the University of New Hampshire. Mr. Miller is a senior staff member for the New Hampshire Citizens Health Initiative and has over 20 years' experience in health policy management. Mr. Miller, thanks so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Patrick, we're at a crossroads in healthcare in this country. Actually, I think we're always at a crossroads in healthcare in this country, which, as you know, is the most expensive healthcare system in the world. And your organization is launched to assist states in their ability to contain health costs by collecting and analyzing real healthcare data. So would you start off by explaining to our listeners the idea of an all-payers claim database?
At its most basic, an all-payer claims database is really a database that's been created through a state mandate that includes data from medical claims, pharmacy claims, dental claims, and it also has eligibility or information, demographic data about the patient, as well as information about the provider. And the data is collected for commercial carriers, so your Anthem, Cignos, Aetnas, et cetera, as well as public payers, so Medicaid, Medicare. Today we have 17 states who have currently passed legislation requiring the development of these systems, but the primary purpose is really to allow policymakers a better understanding of what's actually happening within the healthcare system as it relates to cost, utilization, quality, and other matters.
Well, Patrick, the all-payer claim database sounds like a great idea, and yet still a minority of states have them. But in the states that have set up the database, what have been the different approaches to setting them up, and how's that affected what actually goes into them? Are they able to get the data from all the sources that you described?
The data sets sometimes come from sort of different perspectives or in terms of how they get launched. Sometimes it might be a state Medicaid program that's interested in better understanding how the Medicaid population might benchmark with the commercial population, as an example, or a state might be their insurance department who is interested from sort of a regulatory perspective. We have one state that hasn't passed legislation yet but is moving in that direction, and it actually came from the healthcare provider community, and it was a cancer consortium. I think from my perspective, in order to truly understand what's happening within the system, you have to be able to measure it, and you can't measure it if you don't have the data information. A lot of focus right now has been taking place around health information exchange, the ability to link electronic health records together for movement of clinical data, but not as much of a focus on the administrative data. And ultimately, there will be linkages between the administrative data and the clinical data to provide a much more robust picture about what's actually happening from a health status perspective. So it's absolutely a field that's evolving rapidly. Much talk in the news as well about health insurance exchanges, and there's also a clear opportunity to link this claims data, this administrative data, with the health insurance exchanges in several states, including Connecticut and New York, are pursuing that particular path.
Patrick, the Affordable Care Act is attempting to positively impact how we pay for healthcare, and envisioned in the Affordable Care Act is really a movement towards a payment system focused in on value and outcomes. So tell us what we're learning from these all-payer claim databases about better streamlining expenditures to contain cost.
These databases can actually be very helpful in terms of health reform and how we're thinking about it. At sort of the most basic level, what we're talking about is a health information strategy that's going to support population health and health reform. And that strategy, from my perspective, needs to include the all-payer claims databases combined with the clinical data that's in the HIEs, combined with other repositories that may exist within, say, a state public health department, such as disease registries, et cetera. Several projects are underway right now that are supportive of what's going on with the Affordable Care Act in terms of accountable care organizations would be a good example of that to help set some of the targets for what payment should look like moving forward, what the utilization and spending targets should be, but also starting to look at things such as risk stratification for chronic conditions. I think sort of most immediately we'll see just for the first time for many states being able to just understand how much truly is being spent, where are the dollars going, mm-hmm. In terms of geography, but also in terms of health systems, the types of services, et cetera.
So, Patrick, that sort of brings a couple of questions together in my mind. And it would seem as the all-payer claims databases are established in the states, of course, I'm sure a fundamental question is privacy and making sure the privacy of both individual patients and providers, too, I would imagine, are protected, balanced against accessibility to the data. And I'm going to ask you in a minute to comment on who does have access to this data. But I can't help but thinking this has huge implications for the public health community. And so maybe you could sort of address that balancing of privacy, access, and usability by communities like the public health community as one of the areas of thinking and development around the databases.
I think sort of starting at the end there, the population health example, I think is a really powerful one. And one of the ones from sort of a use case perspective, I think states really start with when they get access to this database. So it's kind of the Google Maps kind of perspective, whereby you start by looking at the world and then you zoom into the continent and down to the country, et cetera. And I think these databases are really useful for that type of population health analytics. You know, one of the states pretty early on in 2005 did quite a bit of prevalence mapping for various disease conditions and did it at a county level, did it at a health service area level, et cetera. And it was very apparent very quickly in terms of, you know, where the problem geographies were. And it allowed the public health department to be able to refocus some of its own expenditures. And it also allowed the state to benchmark its commercial population with its Medicaid population. And I think this is a really sort of critical point with the all-payer data sets is if you have commercial data, you have Medicaid data, and you have Medicare data, you can really start to see the similarities and differences between these populations. And I think that's a really powerful tool for states to have. In terms of privacy and access to data, this question comes up quite a bit. It's highly regulated by the state in terms of what their privacy practices are that they put into place. So some states have built websites that are publicly available, and so you get a certain view of the data. You're not seeing, you know, clearly a patient name. You're probably not even seeing, you know, a hospital or a payer, but you might be getting some high-level population health reporting or per capita cost reporting, as example. There are actually data sets that states are releasing, typically in two formats. One is called a public use file, which strips out things like payment information, but you can do a lot of analysis with that public use data set. For the researcher who wants to kind of go to that next level of analysis, most states have what's called a limited use file. And there's a data use agreement, there's an application, and you're only given sort of the minimum data required to do a particular study. Every state's a little bit different in terms of release. Some of the northern New England states have much broader release policies with the pure intent of having researchers, think tanks, provider organizations, and other folks have access to the data. And in the future, when data begins to be linked, that type of linkage again, would take place behind the state's firewall, and then, again, a de-identified file released.
We're speaking today with Patrick Miller, founder and co-chair of the National All-Payers Claim Database Council, which seeks to improve healthcare in this country through health cost transparency and the efficient collection of health data. The council was established through the New Hampshire Institute for Health Policy and Practice at the University of New Hampshire, where Mr. Miller is a research professor. Patrick, talk to us a little bit about the mechanics of a state adopting the all-payer claim database model. You have 17, you said, of the 50 states. What's been the obstacles for states to take this on? And are there a number of states on the precipice of joining in?
So a lot of the states actually started to create these data sets prior to both the HITECH Act being passed as well as PPACA. It was really done out of the sort of a apparent need that we've talked about today to really understand, well, what's happening in my state? I understand that costs are out of control. Premiums are high. What's actually going on? And so some of the states that got started in sort of the early 2000s were sort of doing it a little bit ahead of the curve, if you will. In terms of the process, typically there is a legislative requirement. There are some states that have been able to do it through through rulemaking, but primarily it's a legislative requirement, which I think is fantastic in the sense that it creates a dialogue amongst the stakeholders about the value of the databases, what data will be in it, who will have access to it. I think in the more recent years, it's been a little bit harder for some of the states to move forward just because there is so much on the plate within each of the states as they wrestle with health reform, whether it's, you know, what's their strategy for insurance exchange or how we're going to meet some of the other requirements, as well as they have major IT projects underway around health information exchange to combine the clinical data sets within the states. And many of them also have Medicaid expansion programs. So there's a lot going on within the state. And I think what we're seeing is really a lot of good leveraging right now of resources, where states are saying, well, do I really need to build a completely separate database, or can I integrate this claims data with a database that exists already? And an example of that would be the health information exchanges on the clinical side. And that makes a lot of logical sense, because there are benefits for bringing that data together for public health research. And the states that have separate platforms will either build them in such a way that they can be integrated down the road, and those that are in existing today will be continuing to look for ways to achieve that level of integration.
And, of course, hopefully the health insurance exchange means there'll be fewer of the missing people that we think of as the uninsured, whose claims aren't being reported to anybody outside
the
organizations where they're
coming from. Right, because the hospital discharge data does have the uninsured for the hospital discharge portion, but it's missing the pharmacy and outpatient,
right,
et cetera. And you're right. I mean, the goal would be that nobody would be without insurance, and then everybody would be in these data sets. You know, from a health services research perspective, not knowing what's actually happening in that population, it's a big problem.
So, Patrick, we've just had the nation's top health IT gurus in Washington for the annual Health 2.0 Data Palooza gathering that's launched by CMS. So how do the all-player claims databases fit with the other large data gathering programs that exist at Medicare and Medicaid and the VA and others? And I guess I have to ask, have there been any great apps developed out of the all-claims databases so far?
Sure. So the idea behind the all-player claims databases is that the state would pull in as many data sets as it can to create that view of its population. So states typically start with their own Medicaid data as well as their commercial population. And then we've had about half a dozen states now add the Medicare data into their databases. And we actually worked very proactively with CMS last year in a great process to actually bring sort of a streamlined application process for states to gain access to Medicare data for research purposes. It had been very costly and hard to get prior to that, and that process has allowed several states to apply for data and receive it in a more timely fashion. I think that's the goal. VA and Federal Employee Health Benefits, Indian Health Service is of interest in some other states as well. Those are data sets that currently there has been no clear path as to how states will acquire that data. But once I think we see states such as Virginia, who's implementing now, and others that have large military populations as an example, I think that will open doors for further federal-state partnerships around the analytics here. I think the other thing that may be helpful too, especially in a continuing relationship with CMS, is the fact that if the states can take a look at, for example, the 55 to 64-year-old population, which is eventually going to be the Medicare population, I think there's a lot of interesting beneficial opportunities for federal and state, again, to share information back and forth. A lot of what's been developed to date have been sort of, we are starting to see more web-based development. There are several products, tools, if you will, that have been developed by states for consumers, for pricing information. Colorado has recently launched a new data set and a web-based tool that anybody with a browser can get to, and I think we'll see more of that as time moves on. I think a lot of the innovation will come for those states that have what I would call proactive data release strategies. My sense is that's where a lot of the innovation will come from, much like what CMS is doing through Datapalooza in terms of, you know, making their data more available to application developers. So I think it's only going to become, more readily available over time. You also have to remember, too, that claims data, there's typically a lag of 6 to 9 months from the time the claim is paid to the time that data becomes available. So for depending upon what it is you're trying to do, you know, it might be the right data set, but in other cases, you might need to go to a more clinical data set, such as the electronic prescribing network or, you know, laboratory data or other things. So it's really going to depend upon, you know, what the developer's trying to achieve as to what source we'll use.
We've been speaking today with Patrick Miller, founder of the National All Payers Claim Database Council at the New Hampshire Institute for Health Policy and Practice. You can find out more by going to apcdcouncil.org. Patrick, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations for Healthcare.
I really appreciate the opportunity, and thank you very much for having me.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act has been controversial. So far, 29 states, including the District of Columbia, support the expansion, 20 oppose it, and 2 are still considering it. Now, conservative critics in Arizona are misrepresenting a study on the health benefits of the expansion, which will extend health insurance to more low-income people. The group, called American Commitment, has launched a series of web ads aimed at state lawmakers. The ads claim that, quote, a recent study shows that Medicaid doesn't even improve physical health. But that's a distortion. The study, which was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, found several positive benefits, and it measured only 3 health indicators in Oregon over a 2-year period. The study found that providing Medicaid coverage didn't significantly improve measured blood pressure, cholesterol, or glycated hemoglobin levels, which monitors diabetes, but those are the only physical indicators it considered. The study also found substantial improvements in mental health, financial well-being, and feelings of physical health. So the findings were mixed. Also, one author has cautioned against generalizing the results, as the study was only conducted in Oregon and only covered 2 years. The Arizona Senate has passed the state's Medicaid expansion plan, which is supported by Governor Jan Brewer. The House has yet to vote on it. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When developer and entrepreneur Steve Cashman was cooling his heels in an urgent care waiting room awaiting attention for a daughter's apparent ear infection, he had a aha moment. He could see plenty of doctors waiting in the back for patients to be processed through the system, and he thought there's got to be a better solution to managing the process. His idea? Why not design and build a contained pod that could be easily installed in any number of high-density locations, schools, senior centers, health centers? He invented the HealthSpot, an enclosed kiosk that gives patients access to a network of doctors through a video chat experience. With the help of a medical assistant and actual medical instruments located in the pod, providers are able to dispense medical advice as if they were right there.
Rather than pick up the phone and call your doctor and try to fit your schedule in, you're going to find the closest health spot to where you need to be that day. You're going to walk through a touchscreen menu and indicate what symptoms you have.
The idea is that many of the reasons for going to urgent care or the ER can be dealt with more efficiently and rapidly with a simple telemedicine consult. The clinician directs the patient in the kiosk how to use the simple diagnostic tools for eyes, ears, blood pressure, etc. The HealthSpot kiosks have already been deployed to several locations, including the Rainbow Care Connection in Cleveland, Ohio, a pediatric practice serving a large number of patients. Rainbow's medical director says these kiosks products could conceivably remove about 70% of their cases out of the patient's stream.
It would be much more cost-effective to have children seen in their primary care office or in these low-cost rainbow health spot stations.
The Health Spot, a standalone contained telemedicine kiosk with simple diagnostic tools that assist patients in quickly diagnosing conditions that can be treated with a teleconsult. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.